Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. We have more diet books, eating plans, and gyms available to us than ever in history. Yet 70% of the nation remains overweight. Food cravings are a major reason why we can't shed those unwanted pounds. For some, it's that irresistible bread, and others, they crave sweets. And then there's those like me that crave crunchy snacks. And of course, many of us can't eat just one, which can lead to binge eating. What exactly causes cravings, and does a particular food we crave tell us anything about our personality? Joining us today is Dr. Glenn Livingston, author of Never Binge Again. If you want to reduce your cravings and finally get off that diet roller coaster, don't go anywhere. It all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is a veteran psychologist and former CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm that serves several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. He's appeared on ABC, WGN, CBS, UPN TV. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the New York Daily News, just to name a few. After getting disillusioned by what traditional psychology had to offer overweight and food-obsessed people, he spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating. He self-funded a research program with over 40,000 participants who struggled with their weight. What he found may surprise you. Here to share how to break free of your food prison and attain your healthy weight, welcome to the show, author of Never Binge Again, Dr. Glenn Livingston.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Oh, it's great. I've been reading your book. It's a pleasure having you on the show. You know, there's certainly no shortage of diet programs and books giving us healthy eating blueprints. They're all over. But there's that one common problem. I'll just have a couple potato chips, which ends up being the entire bag. Share with us why so many people's willpower is no match against the luring power of food.
There's a variety of reasons. And chief among them is the engineering of these food-like substances by industry, which are designed to hit our bliss point without giving us the nutrition to feel satisfied. And then the advertising industry is very effective at making us feel like we can't live without them. And the addiction treatment industry makes us feel like we're powerless to resist even if we wanted to. So there's kind of a perfect storm that makes it virtually impossible for, I say virtually because there really are some solutions, but it makes it virtually impossible for people to step out and keep to their best judgment about food. I remember
right.
There's a bunch of mythologies about how to manage cravings and define healthy eating for yourself that actually wind up wearing down your willpower. So that's
right.
Why I can go into any more specific.
Yeah, so I was wondering, I know in your research, is there a specific factor why people binge? Have you found it's more hormonal, more chemical, emotional, or something out of sheer boredom? What is your research found, or is there like a mixture? What's like the top?
So the research that I did correlated people's life satisfaction areas and personalities with the particular foods that they binged on. And I discovered that people who binge on chocolate, they tend to be lonely or brokenhearted, and I was among those.
Right.
People who binge on salty, crunchy things tend to be more stressed at work, and people who binge on soft, chewy, starchy things like bagels or bread or even pizza, they tend to be more stressed at home. So there is that factor. I think there are a variety of emotional correlates, but I actually found as a result of that study that attempting to solve the emotional problem in order to stop overeating is kind of a mistake because, I'll give you an example. I figured out that when I was a kid, I was set up to eat chocolate because when I was about 1 or 2 years old, my grandfather had just gotten out of prison and my mother was really depressed about it. She didn't know that he was guilty and he was. And my father was in the army. We were talking about sending him to Vietnam. And so she was terrified that he was going to be taken away and she didn't have the wherewithal to hug me and hold me and, you know, feed me healthy things. So she got a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup and she put it in a refrigerator on the floor. And I used to run over and suck on the bottle and go into a chocolate sugar coma. And you would think that when I figured that out, that I would stop having a chocolate problem. And if I was in the movies, I'd give my mom a big hug, we'd have a big cry, forgive each other, and then I'd never have trouble with chocolate again. But I actually wound up having more trouble with chocolate. And the reason is there was this little voice in my head. And that voice went something like, "Hey, Glenn, you know, you're right. Your mama left a big chocolate-sized hole in our heart. And until you can find the love of your life and stop being so lonely and brokenhearted, then you got to go out and binge on chocolate. Let's go get some now. Yippee." And what I learned from that was that it doesn't matter so much why. It does. It's an important conversation to have, but it's not really going to fix the problem. Where the opportunity to fix the problem is in disempowering that illogical voice that justifies why it's okay to binge when you'd made every commitment and decision not to beforehand. And from there, I started to look at, cause I come from a family of psychologists, so I always thought, it's not what you're eating, it's what's eating you. So I tried to love myself thin for years, and it just didn't work. So I started to look at the neurology of the way the addictive brain was set up. And really, the seat of addiction is the reptilian brain, the earliest, most primitive part of our brain, that doesn't know love. The reptilian brain doesn't know love. It looks at something in the environment and it says, do I eat it, do I mate with it, or do I kill it? Whereas the things that are important to us, like other people and long-term goals and plans and creativity and music and art and spirituality and all that kind of thing, those are really in the upper brain. And the upper brain is set up to be dominant to the lower brain. You know, before we eat, mate, or kill something, we're able to ask ourselves, what impact is this going to have on my tribe or my family or those that I love or my longer-term goals? And so we really do have the ability to dominate this addictive feeling, but it's not by nurturing your inner wounded child. It's more like an alpha wolf that is staring down a competitor that's challenging for leadership. And that alpha wolf, if there's a challenger, snarls and does more aggressive things that basically say, get back in line or I'll kill you. And so I can tell you personally, after 30 years of struggling with food for myself, that and all the sophisticated research and all my credentials, what actually helped me to stop binge eating was drawing a line on the sand, making a clear rule. For example, I'll never have chocolate Monday to Friday again. And if I heard a little voice in my head that said for any reason that it was okay to have chocolate, like, you know, grows on a cocoa bean is a plant, so therefore it's a vegetable. If I heard that voice at all, I'd say, well, I don't want chocolate. My pig does. The chocolate is pig slop. The pig is squealing for slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And that crazy primitive notion is what, it gave me those extra microseconds at the moment of impulse to make the right decision. And a very, very condensed story that I'm telling, but slowly but surely, I was able to recover and, you know, lose my 60 pounds and get my triglycerides down and get rid of the food obsession. So my life was back under control.
Was there was there something you reached for that satisfied your chocolate craving, or did you just say, hey, I can't have it from this day to this day?
Well, that's interesting. I finally discovered that there's usually an authentic need underneath every craving. Mm-hmm. So for me, people are going to think this is crazy, but I started to make kale banana smoothies. And when I craved chocolate, I would just go and put 3 bananas in the blender and a couple of stalks of kale in the juicer, and I would drink it up real quick. And I didn't get the same high, because, you know, when you eat chocolate, it's kind of a drug, and you get a unnatural sensation of pleasure. And I didn't get that, but it killed the craving. And before you knew it, like within a month or two, at first I thought it was really disgusting, but within a month or two, I started to crave the kale banana smoothies as opposed to the chocolate. And I think I was meeting some authentic biological need that was distorted by the chocolate, but that my body actually had to be fulfilled.
That's great. I love the personality thing. And, you know, it really explains why after a woman has a bad breakup with her boyfriend, she turns to her two best friends, Ben and Jerry. And it explains my cravings. I crave crunchy snacks. And as a CEO, radio host, doctor, and author, my stress comes solely from work. And I crave things that are crunchy when I get home. I used to be obsessed with popcorn. So is it possible to keep stress from controlling our appetite no matter what personality you fall into?
Well, yeah. There are a couple of things you can do there. First of all, the reason that stress can stimulate a binge is because it activates the fight or flight response inside of us. And so if you do things that deactivate the fight or flight response, and you know, when you're in stress, your sympathetic nervous system is activated. And when you do things that activate the parasympathetic nervous system that take you out of stress, like when you have the craving, before you go and get what you want to get. So before you go get your pretzels or Doritos or whatever you're going to get, you take a deep breath and you tense all your muscles as much as you can. So you kind of exaggerate the stress at the moment. And then you let it all go. And if you can do that three times, that's often enough to deactivate the fight or flight system and kind of wake you up and help you remember the kind of person you're trying to be or whatever your goal was around the Doritos or chips right. or pretzels or whatever it was going to be. The other thing is you can tell yourself a couple of things. First of all, if you have six problems and then you overeat, you're going to have seven problems. So the chips are not going to make it better. The pretzels are not going to make it better. It's going to just be a temporary distraction that actually makes things worse. And then you have the additional stress of recovering from the chips or Doritos, whatever it is that you might have done. And I tell people that, you know, these foods are engineered to make it feel like a matter of survival. It's not an accident that people say, hand over the chocolate and nobody gets hurt. Mm-hmm. It's not an accident that you feel like every bone in your body needs to have those pretzels at that moment and there's no other choice. But feelings aren't facts. And if you remember that and you take that breath, and if you have very clearly defined what healthy eating means to you, so if I were coaching you, I'd ask you, well, what role do you want those pretzels to play in your life? Do you want to be able to have them twice a week, a handful, how much? What would you feel was a healthy treat for you that didn't interfere too much with your overall health and fitness goals? And define it very, very clearly so that you don't have to make decisions at the moment of impulse. See, we live in a culture where we're told to, you know, just eat well 90% of the time and indulge 10%. But the problem with that is that all the research on willpower shows that decision-making wears down your willpower. And if you're trying to eat well 90% of the time, every time you're in front of a bowl of pretzels, you have to ask, is this part of the 90% or this part of the 10%? And it's another decision you have to make. There are only so many good decisions you can make any given day. That's what the research says. So what you want to do instead is make a rule. Say, I don't have pretzels Monday through Friday, or I only have pretzels on Wednesdays and Saturdays, whatever it is, so you can cut out a whole lot of the decisions that you have to make during the week. And if you combine these things, then you're not wearing down your willpower. You're intervening with the automated response of the fight or flight system. You're taking yourself out of fight or flight mode and activating the parasympathetic nervous system. And you're giving yourself the opportunity to wake up and remember who you are and what you wanted to do with food in the first place. So those are just some of the things you can do. But it all starts with making a really clear rule that defines healthy versus unhealthy behavior for you, having some alternatives, and being willing to aggressively take control and say, well, you know, if I say I'm not going to have pretzels other than Wednesday and Saturday, and I hear something inside me that says I should really have that because it's so stressful, you know that that's not you. That's your inner reptilian brain. I call mine my pig. And you can take a breath and walk aside from that.
Yeah. You know, I love that point that you're saying that if you've got six problems and you overeat, that you create a seventh. I like that. I'm going to share that with a patient of mine who weighs 360 pounds. He told me whenever he has bad news or stress, he'll scarf down literally six Big Macs in one sitting. When he's not stressed, it's one or two Big Macs, fill him up. So I'm going to say to him that, and say, hey, will those extra four or five Big Macs make your problems better or add more? That's, you know, people, we don't think of that. I mean, that makes it, instead of baby steps, it's baby bites, you know, to bring.
There you go.
Yeah, I love that. So share with us.
Sounds like a new book title.
I've been known to give quite a few. I've been actually got some credit for a few. That's how my brain thinks. Yeah. As a word guy. I love your chapter 8. You talk about defeating the food industry. Share with us why the industry that supplies our food can be our enemy. You know, is it too much salt they're adding, chemicals? Is it advertising? Share what's the big draw.
Well, there are billions of dollars that go into creating these food-like substances. They're hyper-palatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and oil and excitotoxins. And they really short-circuit our pleasure mechanism. And if you look at the animal studies and what happens when you, for example, put an electrode directly into the pleasure center, and I know we're not doing that, but you can walk out of a McDonald's and see another McDonald's across the street. When they do that with rats, for example, and let them self-stimulate by pressing a lever, those rats will forget about their survival needs. Like a starving rat will press that button thousands of times a day until it's dead, just forgets to eat. A nursing mother rat will abandon her pups and rats will crawl over painful electrical grids to go press that button thousands of times per day. When we present our nervous systems with the opportunity for supersized pleasurable stimulus, it hijacks the survival mechanism and it makes us forget about what we actually need to do. And that's dangerous. On top of that, it's legal for the food industry to trick us. For example, I was working with a major food bar manufacturer, and the VP told me that their most profitable insight was when they took the vitamins out of the bar and they put the money into the packaging instead. And what they did with the packaging was they made it have a variety of vibrant colors so that it would signal. In nature, vibrant colors signals the availability of a diversity of nutrients. When you see a salad that has purple cabbage and yellow carrots and green broccoli and green leafy vegetables and, you know, such a variety of color, the reason we're attracted to that, as a matter of fact, probably the reason we're attracted to color in the first place, is because it signals the diversity of nutrients available. So what was he telling me there? He said, we make money by faking you out. We make you think that it's nutritious with the packaging, but we actually make more money when we take the nutrition out of it. And that goes on all over the place. I don't mean to single out a food bar manufacturer. That goes on all over the place where the consumer, it's not just the industry's fault. The consumer actually wants to be lied to. They want to believe that potato chips are healthy for you. And so if you fry them in canola oil or olive oil instead of some hydrogenated oil, they believe that, well, these are good for you. They might be less bad for you, but they're not good for you. And the baking or frying process still creates acrylamides, which are carcinogenic. But there's so much profit in creating this relationship with the consumer where the consumer gets to believe what they want to believe and, you know, they get to deny what they're actually doing and just slowly kill themselves with food, that there's just not nearly enough regulation. And I don't think that's going to happen for, you know, 20 to 50 years. So the only defense is really a good offense, to sit back and think about specifically, like, if you're going to have potato chips, how many potato chips are you going to have and when? And like, draw an archery target for yourself. Where is the bullseye? Where does the bullseye end? And if you're not going to hit the bullseye, like when you go out to eat or something, then where's the next rung of the target? When you are, maybe you're allowed to have two slices of bread when you're at a restaurant or one serving of dessert or something like that. But try to take so many decisions out of the loop. Don't make impulsive decisions. Any place you're having trouble, try to pre-make your decisions so that you're not wearing down your willpower, and then people tend to do better.
Yeah, and it makes sense, because if the industry we're relying on to supply our food is sabotaging our thoughts with advertisements and hacking into our biochemistry with certain ingredients, I mean, it's tough to fight back. I guess you have to really read labels. Maybe people have to go organic, grow their own. Isn't there a way out of that?
Well, you know, there are between 5,000 and 7,000 advertising messages beamed out through the internet and the airwaves every year. And maybe 5 or 6 of them are about eating more whole fruits and vegetables. So you need to say to yourself that this is what's going on. This is what we're up against. And if you want to counteract that, I like to see people make rules about adding more to their diet, like, you know, have at least 5 servings of whole fruits and vegetables every day. And when you do that, you are reintroducing what nature has to offer, and you're reminding your survival drive that, look, there are these enzymes and vitamins and God knows what else. I mean, we've identified 100,000 vitamins and minerals or so, but we don't know all the vitamins and minerals that are in fruits and vegetables. There are a lot of coenzymes and factors that make them more digestible and useful for us. So by reintroducing just whole natural foods, which doesn't make anybody much money, but you start to remind your survival drive where it's supposed to go, and some of the cravings for the industrial foods, you know, the desire to look for love at the bottom of a bag, box, or container, that starts to disappear.
Right.
I'm not sure if I answered your question. What was the question?
No, you did good. I want to ask you, the subtitle of your book, Never Binge Again, is Reprogram Yourself to Think Like a Permanently Thin Person. So tell us how someone overweight can think like a thin person. Is it affirmations? Do they shout, I am thin, and I am thin? Or as you think if you become?
I'm not one of those touchy-feely psychologists. I'm a take-no-prisoners kind of guy. What you want to do is aggressively separate your constructive versus destructive thinking. So if you make a bright line, I will never eat chocolate Monday to Friday again, then you know that any voice you hear in your head all week long is your inner pig or your, you don't have to call it a pig, you can call it a food demon or your food monster or something like that.
Right.
And what happens with that is very subtle, but you're starting to treat your reptilian brain in the same way that you treat your other bodily organs. It's like your bladder. It no longer has control because you say, well, I'm superior to my reptilian brain. And by doing that, you begin to assign all of the doubt and insecurity to that bodily organ and not to your identity. And if you're, for example, if you're scared that you might binge, well, I really might have chocolate today, and you switch your language and say, well, I'm not afraid that I might binge, it's just that my pig really, really wants chocolate. You have then moved that doubt and insecurity into something that you're not really identifying with yourself, and you've subtly begun to identify with a more successful identity, and you'll begin to collect evidence of success. If you keep collecting evidence of success, even if you make a mistake, so maybe you made a mistake and you had half as much chocolate as you would normally have, or maybe what would normally be a 3,000-calorie chocolate binge was only a 1,000-calorie chocolate binge, and you take note of that and you coalesce that into your success identity, you eventually become a successful person. As long as you believe that that doubt and insecurity belongs to your personal identity, you will embrace it and eventually feel like you have to do something about it because it creates a cognitive dissonance and a discomfort in your psyche. And that's what really makes it possible for you to binge. So when I say reprogram yourself to think like a permanently thin person, what I really mean is to make a commitment to separate your constructive versus destructive thinking about food.
That makes sense. Great. I want to ask you, from your research, did you find any relevance to alcohol coming into play when it comes to binge eating? Like, you know, things like beer and wine tend to make people want to nosh more.
Yeah, it wasn't in the research, but, you know, we've worked with over 1,000 clients at this point, and I can tell you for certain that most people, if they have more than two drinks, they lose a good deal of their inability to stick with their plan. It's the inhibition of the frontal lobe and the inhibition of your inhibitions, right? You lose the ability to stop your impulses as well as you could, and you lose your judgment, which is why we don't get behind the wheel of a car when we're drinking, and you might not want to get behind the wheel of a donut when you're drinking either.
That makes sense. In your book, you mentioned a craving defeater wallet card. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's mostly something that just reminds you of what to do when you have a craving, which I've told you already, which is you say, well, this craving is not on my plan. Therefore, it's pig slop. I don't want it. My pig does. And I never eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And as crazy as that sounds, I know it's embarrassing for a sophisticated psychologist like me to be talking like this, but it turns out you don't have access to your sophistication at those moments of impulses. You need something that's very primitive and stops you in your tracks. And so the craving defeater wallet card is just a reminder of what to do when you have a craving.
It's the tough love. No, that makes sense. I think that's what you need. And sometimes it's that little, it's a simple little voice that just reasoning that just makes sense. It's not always the science. It's just hey, do you want to wear those pair of pants again or do you not? Something like that. Or maybe take a picture of the pair of pants you want to fit into and maybe look at that picture of that. Ew, I want to fit in those. I'm not going to eat this today.
Sometimes people, I tell them not to do this in the middle of the store, or at least not to be wearing a Never Binge Again t-shirt when they do. But sometimes they will put up both their middle fingers up in the air and say, screw you, screw to the whatever they're going to call their pig or their food demon or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And you say, I'm in control. Get back in your cage.
I love it. Yeah, you don't let food control you. Fantastic. We shared some great information today. That's just like I said, I'm almost done with your book. I'm enjoying it. It's really simple to read, and it's not a whole lot of science. It's great if people can get it and understand it. I think you took science and made it common sense, and I love that about it. So thanks so much for joining us and sharing such great information. And to learn more about Dr. Livingston or to get his book, Never Binge Again, go to neverbingeagain.com and make sure you check out his blog post and his audios and media library. You can follow Dr. Livingston on Instagram at Livingston Glenn and on Facebook at Never Binge Again. And for my daily health post, I'm at Dr. David Friedman. If you heard something today that somebody you know would benefit from and they just didn't tune in, send them a link to this podcast. It's available at toyourgoodhealthradio.com or radiomd.com. And While you're there, be sure and check out our podcast library and share these segments with friends and family and coworkers and on social media. This information is too important to keep to yourself. You can also subscribe to future podcasts on iHeartRadio and iTunes. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.